You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Welcome. I am Michaela Novak, Senior Fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program for Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. The podcast episode today is the third of a three-part Hayek Program podcast mini-series on entangled political economy. The previous editions, we've been hosting Richard Wagner, Dave Hebert, and we will have Marta Podemska-Miklas. So entangled political economy is a sub-discipline of political economy that explicitly views individuals and the private and public sectors as being intertwined in overlapping exchange relationships along competitive and collaborative dimensions. Inspired by a long tradition in political economy stretching back to Adam Smith and Carl Menger, and drawing upon insights found in complexity, evolutionary, and network theories, entangled political economy studies have expanded significantly in recent years. Entangled political economy researchers have established a research network to promote the research and study of entangled political economy. This body, the Entangled Political Economy Research Network, or EPERN for short, was established in 2020, and I am an associate director of that network. It is my very great pleasure to speak to Marta Podemska-Miklas, who actually is the founder and executive director of EPERN. Marta Podemska-Miklas is the Schnell Family Chair in Econ Capital Systems and Associate Professor in Economics and Management and Public Health at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Originally from Poland, Marta earned her doctorate in economics from George Mason University. Prior to that, she attained a Master of Science in Applied Economics from St. Cloud State University and a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science, also from St. Cloud State. Marta's research networks have been published in a variety of outlets, including Review of Austrian Economics, Journal of Public Finance and Public Choice, and Review of Behavioral Economics. And she co-edited with Dick Wagner and me the Springer publication entitled Realism, Ideology, and the Convulsions of Democracy. Now, as I've mentioned, Marta Podemska-Miklas founded the Entangled Political Economy Research Network in 2020. Now, under her directorship, EPERN is a network of more than 100 scholars interested in advancing the novel approach of entangled political economy. So, Marta, welcome. It is a great pleasure to have you as a guest for this episode of the Hayek Program podcast.
Great. Thank you, Michaela. Thank you for having me, and thank you for this beautiful introduction.
Oh, absolutely. It's my pleasure. So I'd like to actually start our discussion by noting that you're a native of Poland. I am wondering if you might like to share some of your own understandings of the current market-oriented life of your home country as compared to its previous socialist legacy. And I have been noticing, actually, in financial journals and public commentaries over recent weeks, there has been some attention given to, for example, the growth performance of Poland relative to other countries in continental Europe and, let's say, Great Britain. So I suspect the conveyance of some firsthand insight might be helpful to listeners, especially for younger listeners who may not actually have a memory, let alone appreciation for the miseries wrought by economic, socio-cultural, and political repression under communism. What is economic life like in Poland these days, and as far as your memory and knowledge sort of provides it, compared to under the socialist communist regime?
Wonderful question. And I think I can offer a unique perspective that I only am learning about, right? So like, I didn't realize how unique my perspective of Poland is up until recently, but I haven't lived in Poland for 2 decades, right? So I'm returning. I returned in April and I was in Poland for the whole summer. I'm actually going back again. So after 20 years of not living in Poland, I had the opportunity to be there for an extended period of time and to actually live there and not be just a visitor, which, you know, I've done, of course, in the 20 years, I went back and I was sort of like a guest tourist, but now I get to live in Poland and sort of revisit the life that I knew. And there is like the duality of the two perspectives, right? So on the one hand, there is the growth, which is incredible, and the lifestyle changes that it brought about. I remember communism from my childhood. I remember the lines. I remember just the desperation of getting supplies, coffee. Coffee was like this amazing, privileged thing that people stood in lines for. And So there is that, right? And then like I visit now and there is highways and cars and wealth. My friends travel abroad for vacations multiple times a year and so on and so forth, right? And yet the legacy of communism is not escapable, right? Because the public sector is still large. And I think that's where that socialist legacy persists. And I unfortunately had the experience of going through the healthcare system with my dad, right? So my dad is a Polish citizen, and we basically did things that someone with, a retired Pole with modest income, how they experience healthcare. And in a way, like the doctors are as good as they are in the West, but the infrastructure is public, and there that's where that competition arises, right? Like you have to compete for spots in hospitals, and that happens through money and connections. And that's how Poles dealt with socialism, right? Like sometimes, you know, we think, oh, socialist economies were fully planned, and if that was possible, they wouldn't collapse, right? So it was socialism is this conflict between rules and central control and just people trying to live their life and engage in transactions that allow them to survive. And in healthcare, I still see this, right? There are aspects of Polish healthcare that are completely private, and that works well. So fertility treatments and all of that, you can sort of buy with, you access it if you have money, right? But then more in other places, right? Like where in places where you need sophisticated equipment, there is less private investment. Those machines like operation tables, doors, that's all public resources. And Poles still have to sort of compete through the unofficial channels to get access. So that's the legacy. And I think maybe for a while we didn't appreciate that growth didn't benefit everyone in the same way, right? So the 90s already brought this takeoff and the entrepreneurship, and then we became part of the European Union. All of that benefited a great share of society. But then there was a group that was left out, either people who couldn't transition, right? They had a job under socialism, but then just found themselves lost in the new market, under market conditions, or just people from already underprivileged backgrounds. There was a group, and that created a space for populism. And for 7 years, Poland was led by a government that really took on an authoritarian approach. So yes, there is a lot of interest there, and I was quite fascinated by how entangled political economy, by focusing on networks, really gives insight into those the uneven distribution of impact of the new regime, for example.
Yeah, no, that's extremely interesting. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, that is actually really quite an incredible overview that you've sort of provided. So there's a couple of reflections that I have just in response to what you said. So the first thing is that we'll obviously talk about the entangled political economy of healthcare sort of later in this sort of podcast, and you have particular academic and actual, as you've mentioned, practical expertise in this lately. So there's that. But one thing you mentioned in passing is that you sort of alluded to a tension between having to navigate officialdom and the fact of everyday living, and how officialdom can really sort of obstruct and get in the way of everyday living and people's pursuit of individuals' everyday projects. And it seems to me that that's quite interesting, in the sense that you often hear, certainly in sort of Western scholarship over recent decades, this idea of a hostile worlds paradigm between, let's say, community everyday life and the market. Whereas I think what you've just mentioned, your sort of testimony about life in Poland, indicates that actually the hostile worlds thesis actually more readily applies, in fact, to the tension between officialdom in socialist regimes, or even not, and everyday life. And then perhaps a sort of third and final reaction I have, you mentioned the incredible uplift in everyday living standards experienced by Poles over the past few decades post-communism. That sort of reminds me of a funny anecdote I had on a visit once to the Czech Republic, when I had asked a taxi driver about sort of life now, or back in the time, about 2012, 2014, versus life under communism. And his instinctive response was, you know, I love the sort of the freer life in the market now, because I'm able to actually choose the brand of yogurt that I want. You know, and I actually think that really counts for something, in, as a matter of fact. So, yeah, so thank you for that. So what we like to do is let's now turn, if we can, to your intellectual relationship with Richard Wagner, whose entangled political economy framework is the subject of this Hayek Program podcast miniseries, and in fact, the whole program of entangled political economy. So before turning to some of the more substantive issues at play, I guess theoretically and conceptually, what are some of your personal reflections of being mentored by Wagner and of being his co-author on several key papers? What was it like to be a student and later a collaborator of Dix?
Yes, thank you for that question. So Dick has been my promoter, right, in the PhD program. He was the chair of my dissertation committee. He became my co-author already in graduate school, and then we continued that relationship through a couple of projects. There are two things that come to mind, right? Like, first, he's a very generous co-author, so he included me as a grad student, where I really didn't think I had much to offer, and gave me the space to contribute, but also supported me through that process of getting things completed, and then through the revisions. And it was, we all know how referee process can be, and sometimes there's a bit of frustration. So going through all of that with him was great. And the second aspect is just the originality of his thinking and sort of not giving in into what's fashionable. He is driven by curiosity, by trying to understand social life. And he's very committed to that, right? So he's not going to work with the tools that are now popular in the profession, even though that might mean less of a career advancement. But if those tools are not suitable for the questions he wants to ask, he's not going to adapt them. So I think that that commitment was very inspiring to me, because one doesn't go into economics PhD and professorship for any other reason, right? Like, we don't come here to make big bucks or become famous, because, like, that would be very, like, it would not be a good choice of a career path. Yeah, we come here because we have that curiosity, and to see someone who lived his career and built a beautiful career, right, based and the scholarship that's going to influence next generations, is very inspiring.
So, so I'm actually interested in finding out a little bit more about, if I may, I'll put it in Australian vernacular, what Dick Wagner was like as a bloke, right? So I'm thinking about it this way. So he was a student of James Buchanan, and Buchanan himself was very much noted within GMU as being a highly productive scholar who'd, you know, for example, work long hours, who'd have a very quick turnaround, for example, on draft papers as well. Was there any sort of sense that Dick Wagner sort of adopted the same kind of working methods as his own mentor, or was the relationship sort of different? It's very interesting and it's very gratifying to actually hear that he, would obviously sort of treat you with equal intellectual respect and give you sort of room and space to grow in terms of co-authored projects. But I'm also interested just in the ting tacks, if we were, of what he was actually as a scholar.
So if you're asking about the day-to-day productivity, I think he took a lot from James Buchanan, because he's very quick in responding and just very sort of productive in terms of how much he can get done within a week. And I don't know if I should share this or not, but a couple of years ago, we worked under a lot of time pressure because I was due with my third child. And there was a time where Dick didn't sleep through the night, right? So he knew, okay, Marta is going to be out any moment. So there was one time where he basically, worked through the night, sent me the draft in the morning, and I added my part and we got it done. That's the paper in the Journal of Contextual Economics, I believe. But he reflected later, he sent me an email a week later saying, you know, the recovery time is a bit longer when you are in your 80s than when, earlier in his career. And he admitted to having done this on multiple occasions throughout his career, right? Tight deadlines come up. So for me, that was also insightful, right? Because on the one hand, I always thought that he's this, super disciplined, just works in the morning and doesn't do anything as unhealthy as working through the night. And yet, in a difficult situation, he was willing to do that. So yeah, and he is, he's very systematic and capable of producing and explaining ideas in a sort of quick manner. I think where I get hanged up sometimes is just is this ready to share? I think he has the confidence to not get that hesitation, right? He puts his work out there quite fast.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And I think it is actually very important to know that even in retirement, Wagner is keeping on producing scholarship. I think since retirement, there's three, if not four books, including something coming out actually very soon. So there is that. So we'll turn now to some of your co-authored work with Wagner. So in 2013, you co-authored with Wagner on what is now a totemic paper, and personally one of my favorite papers, Entangled Political Economy and All of Economics, published in the Review of Austrian Economics. And the paper is entitled Dyads, Triads, and the Theory of Exchange Between Liberty and Coercion. So I think this paper presents a brilliant reapplication of sociologist Georg Simmel's network distinction of dyads and triads to then explicate the comparative relational effects of economic and political organization. So the key distinction here in the paper is between networked dyads between two voluntary parties and networked triads between two voluntary parties plus a third set of parties coerced into a so-called forced political exchange. So I'm wondering, Marta, if you could please explain the significance of this dyad-triad distinction. What work is it doing for Entangled Political Economy?
Great, yes. So Entangled Political Economy is a study of society as a network, right? We look at societies as networks of connections, and we know those networks are very, very complex. And in your work, you speak of networks, multi-layer networks, and sort of there is that appreciation of complexity. And when we do spend in Entangled Political Economy, a lot of attention goes to sort of the consequences of complexity for political life. And that's very important. In this paper, in this particular paper, we wanted to go sort of very micro and understand from the bottom up what happens in the between individual participants of the network. And at, I think where that micro perspective gets us to the distinction between the two types of relationships, right? So we are all familiar with the voluntary market exchange, right? Or just voluntary, it doesn't even need voluntary giving, right? Like there is that, right? And then the other part, the other type of transaction that is quite different is the transaction that happens at the expense of one of the participants, right? And that's usually a triad, because you will have two participants coming together and exchanging something that they come about at the expense or at the cost to the third participant. And I think that that distinction is quite helpful for me, particularly in trying to understand institutional regimes, for example, right? So we spoke of sort of my perspective on the communist and socialist Poland versus the free market Poland. That distinguishing at that level is not very helpful, because under socialism you had the ads, right? There were still, you know, women who grew food in their backyards and sold it at the market, right? That was a ad, right? It was illegal, but it was still sort of didn't involve exploiting public resources or anyone else. And in market societies, you still have a great number of triads, right? So with using this triad versus dyad, right, like focusing on that, on the types of interactions, allows us to appreciate that there can be socialist or arrangements in any society. And socialist versus sort of free market, it's more about of a spectrum than a sort of like duality, right? Like it's more of a spectrum. So that's helpful. And I think another aspect of this paper that's been useful is the type of property rights, right? That you will see the ads where you have clearly defined private property rights versus triads emerge in inalienable property, right? So if you don't have alienable property rights, you are more likely to see a triad emerge. And then those triads work to convert private into inalienable property.
Yeah, look, I think that's the distinction here is actually incredibly useful for political economy in general. And whenever I read this paper, I'm often reminded of a broader scholarship, not only in, let's say, the study of comparative economic systems. You certainly alluded to that with your cross-reference back to Poland under a communist state versus a sort of freer market state that can be applied, obviously, to any other country. But I'm also, the paper also reminds me of quite a rich, even if somewhat underappreciated scholarship that speaks to the complexities and the nuances of our socialist systems, even if they're entirely inefficient and sort of ham-fisted in terms of their efficiency properties. So in this regard, I think of your paper with Wagner as being a sort of theoretical explanator for other sort of predecessor pieces of scholarship, such as, for example, Walter Eucken, the German auto-liberal economist, wrote a two-part series in 1948 in Economica with respect to the inefficiencies of Nazi Germany, the fascist, right? And so there's a lot of commonalities, actually, between the economic organization of fascism and communism in terms of the inefficiencies that sprout as a result of these triadic sort of relationships. And also Paul Craig Roberts, back in the late 60s from memory, wrote quite an important paper about describing the Soviet Union as a polycentric system, but with peculiar properties, as, you know, Dick Wagner would often say as a turn of phrase, with peculiar properties, which mean that because of the overhanging presence of triadic political relationships within the economic structure, there's absolutely no guarantee whatsoever that efficient and effective production and even consumption outcomes are going to be realized. So I think this is the significance of your paper. It can be sort of used in a quite a modular way to describe these actual real systems.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the Craig Roberts paper. I think we cited in the Diats and Triats paper because that was also a part of the inspiration.
Yeah, exactly. So at about the time of your doctoral studies under Wagner, you co-produced a number of published papers. So one of those, which continues to intrigue, is your 2011 Journal of Public Finance and Public Choice paper. And this paper is entitled Entangled Political Economy and the Two Faces of Entrepreneurship. So, okay, to be certain, there are numerous categorizations of entrepreneurship in academic literature, but I think what's novel about your contribution with Dick is that you've both introduced a distinction between so-called genuine and parasitical entrepreneurship. So I'm wondering if you could briefly describe for our listeners, what's the meaning of that distinction in itself? And is there any implications for entangled political economy and entrepreneurship studies more generally? What do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I think that in a way that paper ties closely to the Diats-Triats distinction, right? So the genuine entrepreneurship is the one that results in the formation of the ads, right? It's the bringing of using creativity to solve problems for other people in exchange for money, typically, right? It's a formation of mutually beneficial relationships versus parasitical is the attaching, right? It's the attachment to the relationships that either already exist or are anticipated to form through an entrepreneur who is basically trying to exploit them. I agree with your point that there are other distinctions. And I mean, there's the private-public distinction, which sort of relates to this one. But there's also many other ways of organizing the entrepreneurship inquiry. There's the focus on social entrepreneurship and versus market entrepreneurship. For me, the helpful way of thinking about this was to look at whether the focus is on ends or means, right? So if we are looking at ends, like social entrepreneurship seeks social change, that's a little difficult because oftentimes it's the markets that bring the social change, right? So you don't have to be a social entrepreneur to create social change. The washing machine resulted in a social change by freeing up women's time, and yet there was no social entrepreneur behind it, right? So I this whole sort of focus on the ends in the entrepreneurship literature wasn't very helpful to me, but the genuine and parasitical speaks to the means, right? Am I trying to accomplish something using means that I procure through voluntary exchange, or am I using them by using the means that I procure through attaching to someone with control over inalienable property?
So I think this paper is extremely important because it actually illuminates a distinction between Wagner's thinking about the nature of political and economic relationships and arguably those of his mentor and teacher, James Buchanan. And so one of the emphases of that particular paper of both of yours is the illumination of so-called parasitical entrepreneurship. And it is actually fascinating to sort of think about then about to what extent Wagner versus his teacher Buchanan focus or give intellectual space not only to consensual relationships, including through the market, but also conflictual relationships as well. I'm reminded of a book chapter that Wagner wrote a few years ago in a volume discussing the political economy and social philosophy of Buchanan, in which Wagner is arguing that Buchanan was certainly very much aware of the capacity for conflict in political exchange. Certainly outside of the sort of domain of constitutional construction and development, let's say in everyday politics. Buchanan is forthrightly acknowledging the existence of conflict, which may or may not provide the sort of basis for productive exchanges between political actors. So there's that. But it's also very interesting to think that Buchanan was incredibly useful and had illustrated a great deal of foresight in producing a survey article, for example, in the early 1960s, it might have been 1960 itself, introducing to English language speakers the Italian tradition in public finance. Now, if anything, my reading of Wagner's observations about Buchanan is that, yes, surely Buchanan is recognizing conflict, parasitical entrepreneurship within the political domain, if you will. But it seemed to me that if there's any charge that Wagner is leveling, is that Buchanan doesn't seem to sort of go far enough in terms of sort of thinking about the implications of conflict in political exchange. And I suppose that canonically, the greatest example of that in Buchanan is his constitutional political economy, which is all about ways in which heterogeneous individuals can come together to bring about the emergence and the maintenance of rules that people agree upon. So I think this paper of yours that you co-authored with Dirk is extremely interesting because it, I don't know if it necessarily sort of illuminates a tension, but at least potentially a way to build upon Virginia political economy to bring in conflict and how it complements and substitutes consensus and agreement making.
Oh, I love that point. Yeah, I think that's a connection worth exploring. And I recall that paper that Wagner wrote about Buchanan. And I think that tension there is for Buchanan, it was rules, right? The conflict over rules and then within the rules, right? And if you can just get the rules right, then you will minimize the potential for the conflict within the rules versus Dix is sort of more of a, even the rules are subject to erosion through parasitical entrepreneurship, and we will have conflict over both. And I think what Wagner takes from that, the key thing that I see in Wagner, right, sort of driving this distinction from the and that he takes from the Italian scholars, is the Pareto's choice and consequence, right? So the logical, non-logical action. And the logical action, when that's the genuine entrepreneurship, right? Like that would be where I'm trying to sell you something and you can tell whether this is going to work for you or not, versus the non-logical action is I'm giving you a promise of a beautiful future. You don't know if that's going to be how I tell you, but it feels good to be a part of this group, right? So it's, there's something that I offer that you actually get in the moment of exchange, right? Like if you support my political cause, you're becoming part of something. And then Dick speaks to that sort of like, we care how we are perceived. And there's like, there's rewards of being part of a group, just the emotion, right, of it, even though you don't know whether the promises will happen, right? And so that's the non-logical action. And in Pareto, that's religion, right? Or now maybe like how we support sport teams, right? Would be the same, right? Like what we do have no influence on the consequence. Like there's no, what we do and the consequences is quite separated, but the non-genuine, the parasitical entrepreneurs can get us on their side, can get our support just by offering sort of the emotional rewards in the moment.
Yeah, and if I may, before sort of turning to the subject of your sort of current research and future directions in entangled political economy, just wanted to sort of follow up on that. I think what you say is entirely correct, you know, to think about the influence of the sociologist Pareto on Wagner's own thinking. And obviously Buchanan was clearly aware of the implications of Pareto and his scholarship. But you've mentioned clearly another distinction, right, which I think that sort of overlaps, not so much overlaps, it probably maps, right, to the forms of entrepreneurship that your earlier paper refers to. It might even sort of map to general behavior and conduct in market versus state. And so the distinction you've just introduced now following Pareto is logical versus non-logical actions. So we have in the market the provision of what you've indicated in your own scholarship and others, you'll have the provision of experience goods. You can touch, taste, smell, try them out, and you can see as a result as to whether entrepreneur or even advertising promises about the quality and the performance of goods, whether they actually get tested out and achieved in real time, in the real world. Whereas politics seems to sort of map to non-logical action, credence goods, right? Where surely there is coercion, there is a sort of a triadic exchange going on where there are a lot of third parties that are going to lose. And even, citizen voters in their general position of taxpayers find it extraordinarily difficult to be able to test the credibility of claims in politics. So, the healthcare sector is X percent better in one country than Y. It's extraordinarily difficult to work it out unless you're, shuffling between continents, for example, as you have been recently. So it seems to me then it follows from that in order for a lot of political activity to get some sort of rough semblance of legitimacy, non-logical expressions and sentiments have to be tied to the parasitical action in order to gain some legitimacy, if not to quell opposition, just to the very idea that usually what's been sold and spun in politics doesn't really sort of wash out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think, yes, thank you for bringing up the credence versus experiential good distinction. That's quite helpful to me in a number. It's been very helpful, that distinction. And you're right, it relates to healthcare because almost anything can be turned into a credence good if you suppress competition, right? I think maybe that's how socialism was able to survive. And they were very focused on not allowing people to know what the life in the West looked like, right? The restrictions on travel, restrictions on Western culture and so on, right? So if you can keep this sort of parasitical relationship as longer, right, and maintain it if you suppress alternatives.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. I mean, I think that's a very powerful perspective, so I thank you very much for that. So what we might do now, Marsha, if you wish, is to turn to some of your current research and what you believe are some of the critical potential future directions for entangled political economy. So one of the distinguishing features of your research agenda is your focus upon what could be better described as entangled public policy. That is the application of entangled political economy precepts to better understand the production of public policy. A range of your examples have pertained, as we've already discussed, to the healthcare policy space, which now looms very large in the fiscal and policy profiles of Western economies, and probably even now in Eastern Europe, as we've already sort of discussed. So I'm wondering if you could please tell us, what is the relevance of entangled political economy to the study of public policy? Is this entanglement approach attempting to respond to, say, some perceived deficiencies in conventional policy concepts or applications? If so, what deficiencies? What's entangled public policy trying to address? What value does it add?
Yes, okay, that's a great question. I think that the value added comes from comparing it to public choice, right? Because many of the two frameworks, entangled political economy and public choice, they do ask very similar questions. They have similar intellectual origins. The difference is that public choice developed with the tools of the equilibrium economics, neoclassical toolset, and entangled political economy takes on the evolutionary complexity economics toolset. So they operate differently in that manner. And then that has a number of consequences. One of them is that in the public choice, rational ignorance plays a huge explanatory role. So why is it that we get policies that we get? It's because people are uninformed, right? And then Kaplan has a reformulation where it's not rational ignorance, but rational irrationality. So it's the indulgence, right? And I think there's a subtle difference here, maybe not so subtle, but often missed, which for the in entangled political economy, the work is not done in the heads of the voters, it's the institutional environment. Basically, it's the institutions that sever the tie between the choice and the consequence, and that's what they create sort of this non-logical, emotional decision-making. And I think that's very important because instead of like, oh, voters are just dumb and we shouldn't, you know, minimize the size of the government because the vote, like if you allow voters to decide on too many matters, the consequences will be terrible, right? Like that's sort of the public choice way of viewing the world. In the entangled political economy, politics is something that is inescapable, and there's always going to be efforts to create sort of inalienable property space, right, for new issues. And you need to be sort of aware that once that happens, the decision-making will be very different.
Yeah, I think the application of entangled political economy to healthcare, which is a project that you very much have led, leads to a range of fascinating implications, including in the public health space. For example, you've written a couple of papers, including one or maybe even both with Wagner, with respect to public policy responses during the COVID period and how these represent rapid entanglements between, say, pharmaceutical interests, other sort of interests in the healthcare space, and also sort of healthcare authorities. Is there any sort of specific lessons that we might learn from that recent COVID experience, do you think?
Everything can be politicized.
Yeah.
I think that because the paper we wrote with Dick, that's in the Journal of Contextual Economics, that paper talks about that, right? Like that we want to believe that there is scientific knowledge out there and the truth can be found out, right? Like if you just put enough resources, you will discover through research, you can find the truth. And maybe, right? But what gets into public policy, it's not the objective sort of averaging of different aspects. It's more of a, we are going to follow the research that suits our agenda a little more. And I think that's really in COVID, that was very visible in terms of the paths that Sweden pursued versus the rest of the Western countries, right? And Sweden benefited from the institutional environment where the chief of the healthcare agency was, the institutions made him accountable both for the deaths and the economic and social costs, right? Like there was one person, like one agency that, yeah, don't let people die, but also if you go too far with the restrictions, we will know, right? Like all these lost jobs, all the sort of economic harm, we will know whom to attribute that to. And that's unique. Everywhere else, there was the visibility of deaths, right? Like in the moment, politicians would be punished by the visible sort of consequences of the pandemic. So spending and giving money away and just like dramatic response to that was the rational consequence and sort of rational choice, right? And the secondary aspect, right? So the economic consequences, well, we see those now, right? It's the inflation, it's the deficit, but it's not like we can point to a particular person and say, okay, they did that, right? So I think the institutional structure made it rational to solicit research or focus on the research that justified the dramatic lockdowns and so on, right? So I guess, I don't know if I'm being very clear, right? But if you have full accountability for your COVID response, both short-term and long-term, you're going to be looking at research more widely than if you are just focused on the short-term consequences. And that's how things get politicized, right? So not every scientist said that lockdowns were the way to go. In fact, there was a lot of controversy around it. And yet, politicians listened to the ones that wanted the lockdowns.
Yeah, thank you for that. Again, a really sort of powerful application of the entangled political economy approach to health. And your references to the correspondence of political action and non-logical action in the healthcare space reminded me actually of a paper that GMU sort of economics professor Robin Hanson wrote, probably about 15, 20 years ago, actually, a paper titled "To the Effect of Healthcare Spending is Showing That You Care." So, you know, so there is this sort of surface level kind of motivation stemming from non-logical action on the part of healthcare policymakers to show that you care. Record spending, record production of vaccines or whatever, warp speed, if you wish. Whereas the real sort of devil in the detail, if we might sort of refer to that way, is really occurring, you know, at a substrate level where you have real entanglements, material entanglements, logistical entanglements, organizational entanglements, right across the spectrum. So I think this approach is really important. So I'd like to now turn, if I may, to some of your additional research efforts. Recently, you've turned some of your scholarly attention to questions of the dynamic and creative character of innovation, a different topic. So what are the key insights stemming from your own innovation research, and how do you see those fitting in with the concept of entangled political economy?
Yes, so that research follows sort of the approach of Roger Koppel, Creative Dynamics. He has a whole research group that has been sort of taking the evolutionary approach to explain the great economic takeoff. And that work is very fascinating. And they too share the sort of evolutionary approach with entangled political economy. So I adapted some of that work and tried to think of how regulation works in those models. And we know that regulations lead to waste, right? Suppress economic transactions. And then there is also the recognition in the literature that some innovation will be suppressed through regulations. But what the Creative Dynamics Koppel's framework does is that it also brings in the secondary innovation. So the innovation that was suppressed would likely unlock more innovations, right? And I think the connection to Wagner's and to entangled political economy is in the credence goods, right? So regulations turn experiential goods into credence goods, right? Like in healthcare, we will have one solution, right? And we don't see what hasn't been done, right? So like if you, for example, in the US healthcare, there's very little integration, right? Even though transaction cost economics would tell you that healthcare is a team production sport, sort of, right? Like it's hard to evaluate individual contributions. In the actual regulatory setting makes it so that it's very fragmented. And there's very little diversity, right? Like states will have different sort of regulatory frameworks, but healthcare itself is very much organized in the same way. The couple of outliers, like the Kaiser Permanente in California or the Cleveland Clinic, or there are a few, but they could never scale, right? They couldn't grow out of their original state. So healthcare is a credence good in a sense that we don't really see the alternatives to it. And I had a hard time explaining that, even or understanding it, not even explaining, but like understanding it. And it's difficult to sort of speak to the about those alternatives. But I think what COPL contributes is that it gives us a way to say, this is how innovation works. Innovation enables adjacent opportunities. And when you suppress one pathway, you're suppressing the entire chain of innovation, right? So like, I think it gives a little more strength to that sort of credence good, right? That the regulation basically sets us on a certain path and prevents that diversity and makes us dependent on the solutions we have.
Thank you very much. And that actually helps us turn to my next and final question, actually, because it seems to me that an alignment of a tangled political economy and this idea of creative dynamics and innovation provides even a new sort of substrand of research endeavor. So as indicated in my preamble to this podcast, you are the executive director of EPERN, the Entangled Political Economy Research Network. And as a disclaimer, as also mentioned, I'm also a part of the executive team of this body, which has over 100 scholar members from around the world with an interest in this field of entangled political economy. So based on sort of your leadership of EPERN and your experience in networking with scholars in this domain, what do you see as some of the more promising newer research directions taken in this field? And how might you see entangled political economy as evolving in the near to medium term? That necessarily involves some peering into a crystal ball, as it were, but it would seem to me that at least the creative dynamics and innovation literature might be one example. Are there any others that spring to your mind?
Yeah, I am very excited about the growth of Entangled Political Economy Research Network, the interest we had. We have scholars from all over the world coming to the seminars and participating and following the website. And I'm most inspired by the research by the younger colleagues, right? So, for example, last year we had a presentation by Maria Chaplia on psychedelics, and that was very much a sort of entrepreneurial journey, right? So first there was the suppression of innovation, and now we see sort of private efforts to bring back that research and sort of return to a more diverse landscape, right? And in my Maria's work, but I think also more broadly in entangled political economy, there's a lot of room for rhetoric. Adam Martin has this paper, and I don't know if I will recall the title,
but it's the Talkative Political Economy.
Yes, entangled political economy is the talkative kind, right? Because in the world of non-logical action, words matter, emotions matter, right? And I think that there's the growth of the network will be in the opportunities that it creates for bringing in the rhetoric. And I'm also excited about the tools. And you've done that with your dissertation too, right? Like paying attention to sort of the language that was used in the social media posts, right? I suspect that the tools we now have at our disposal will make that sort of analysis much easier. It will make also sort of the work that Virgil Storr has done with the anthropological approach a more accessible. I've been toying with the idea of interviewing polls on healthcare, because just in the casual interactions, when you bring up struggling with healthcare, people talk about connections, right? Like immediately a Polish person will tell you, oh, you know, my cousin is a doctor at this hospital. I'll get you a phone number. Right. Like, and that is kind and supportive. Like, that's how but it also speaks to, this is not a purely market, right? Like if it was organized just on a voluntary market basis, I wouldn't need that connection. Right. So I think that's something that will be a subject of exploration, right? The importance of emotions and words and narratives, and how we get how that gets captured, and it's getting a lot of attention in the political sphere these days as well, right? So I think that's a fruitful opportunity for research, and I'm really glad to see young scholars interested in this kind of work.
Yeah, absolutely. So really, with respect to entangled political economy, it is, in a phrase, onward and upward, most certainly. So so with all that in mind, I'd like to thank you very much, Marta Podemska-Miklas, for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Michaela. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you, and I am very grateful for the work you're doing with the mini-series and bringing attention to these ideas. Thank you.
Of course, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.